Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. During that time, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the call over to your host for today, Mr. Jeffrey Forbes. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. So thank you for coming. So I'm really excited to introduce Dan Garcia. I've known Dan for a while. I first met Dan back in 1993 when I was a prospective graduate student at UC Berkeley, and that was a long time ago. But I distinctly remember, I distinctly remember Dan's passion for computer science and how he really made the field seem really exciting, engaging, and something that you want to do. So I did end up going to Berkeley. We spent a lot of time together, played on a very bad basketball team. Computer science basketball team, you'd be surprised. Dan has continued. He's now tenured teaching faculty at Berkeley. And one of the things that he's done there is he's continued to really work on this idea of how do you engage students in computer science. Right? And one of the things he's done is he was inspired by a keynote address at the 60 conference by Grady Booch, which was all about the passion, beauty, joy, and awe of computer science, right? And really try to get at this idea of how do we as faculty and how do we really engage students in what makes computer science interesting. So in response, Dan set off to kind of start his own course and start his own movement. And that's the beauty and joy of computing. That's what he's going to talk about today. And what he was trying to do is change computer science can be viewed as, I've got this written down here, because that was very good, dry, difficult, and irrelevant, to instead something that's engaging, easy to learn, and really transformative for what students want to do in their lives and careers. So this new course, Beauty and Joy Computing, has been really one of the key elements in the CS10K project, an effort to thank you, Dan. Yes, I'm not that tall. an effort to really transform computing education by bringing rigorous, academic, engaging curricula in computer science to 10,000 schools taught by 10,000 well-prepared teachers soon. So thank you, Dan. Look forward to hearing what you tell.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That was awesome. And don't let Jeff tell us short. He was an amazing point guard, and we wouldn't have won the one game we did without Jeff. So thank you. So how many of you know in the room 100% about the CS10K effort? Let's have the hands. I don't see everyone's hand up. Aha! See, I knew I should have the slides in, and I did. So I want to today talk about CS10K. I want to talk about our BJC, Beauty and Joy Computing course. Talk about our nationwide PD efforts to try to go across the country and teach this to the high school teachers, and about going online and our experience doing that and how that all feeds in together in a perfect storm of amazing technology and interest. So I'm borrowing these slides from Jan Cooney. Many of you know she's ill today, but she sends her regards, and these are her slides. So I'm trying to channel her, so I'm going to do my best Jan impression for the next 10 slides or so, which are that we need... Computing is broken right now. Computing is doing well in the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, but computing is broken in society. Why? We are not hitting these three marks. We are not producing enough graduates. They don't look like the rest of the country, and we have no engagement, relatively no engagement in K-12. So kids happen to fall into computer science probably because they happen to have a great teacher, but we are not doing the right thing in K-12. So let's see what we can do to try to fix each of those things. So in terms of underproduction, this is a target. Also, Jan's slides, many of these come from other sources, so this is NC WIST's slide. The purple graph, the total height of the cylinder is the projected job openings, and the green is the total number of annual degrees earned. This is per year. So you notice we're not even filling this cylinder of the number of jobs. And what you're finding from the folks at Google and Facebook is they are converting smart physics majors, and they're going international. They're trying to open up the visas so they can get the flow of talent into the job that they have ready to go because we're not producing enough internally. I'm all happy for a flattened world where other folks are coming in, but we should really still be doing a better job within the country of serving them. And the jobs we're talking about are amazing. This is a CNN Money graph of the best jobs in America, and the ones that are circled are relevant to computing. And notice even the top one, which I think if I squint, is a systems engineer. So this is the best jobs in terms of flexibility, salary, mobility, all the things that kind of you use to measure quality of jobs. Yet, at a time when we need them and these jobs are great, where are the student interests? The student interest isn't there. So this is a graph of the percent of folks intending to major in computer science. Again, this is an NC Wisp slide. Over the course, this is nice, goes back to 82, and you see we had a big bump around the personal computer era and a big bump around the dot-com bubble that came and went, and look where we are, lower than we've ever been. Okay? So it's a scary thing, and we need to really work on that in terms of student interest. So student interest is one thing, and as part of my role, one of my hats I wear is someone on the ACM Education Board. We've been trying to address this and try to remedy this for a while now. This is the folks who are in majoring in computing, so this is BS total enrollment, average per department again since 2000. And we see we were falling since the bubble, and we've kind of rebounded a little bit. And some folks have rebounded better than others. So usually the numbers, what I'm hearing in a national space is you rebound mostly on the coast. So they see it first, and they're kind of trickled down there. So at Stanford, their numbers are going through the roof. They have as many people in their computer science program as they've ever had in their history. We at Berkeley, just this last fall, had 1,000 students want to be a major. An incredible number. And we've been turning away 100 people who want to be part of our program and we can't support. So just because of the size of the room and the number of things, we just can't support 1,000 people in our class. We can try 800, which is bigger than we've ever had, but we can't do 1,000. So it's sad we've been turning away. So at some folks on the coast are seeing great rebounds. So we're doing very well on the coast, but we'll see it later propagate back into the middle. In terms of urban representation, we certainly aren't seeing people going into computing who look like us. So these are people taking the advanced placement high school exam, and this is a gender breakdown. And you'll see the biology is 50 and 42 women to men. Stats and calculus are about balance. And CS is now at 19 to 81. In fact, I'm to understand that this is the worst gender balance in the history of the AP. They've never had a year where it was worse than 19 to 81. That's scary, that we are now at the worst. You know, it's like, oh, well, at least the first derivative is going up. We were bad for a while, but now we're going up. No, my understanding is right now we are as bad as ever been, and it's not clear that it's going to be any better. So we're not doing a great job in terms of engaging young women in high school to think about computing, to take this course, and eventually take this exam. In terms of how does that affect folks in college, this is a really longitudinal look. Look at this. This is starting in the 70s. This is a 40-year look of where are folks going in, where are women going into STEM in college? And unfortunately, the colors don't show up so well, but the one that kind of continues to rise and rise and rise and rise, if you're a stock person, I would say buy on that line right there. That would be biology, biomedical sciences, you can guess there. So math, and look at math and stats doing great. They're kind of 50% that they're trickling with that, and they're kind of selling at 45. They're doing fine. Physical sciences is climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing. They're doing great. Now let's see these last two. And colors are right on my computer. Engineering is the lowest one. Engineering starts really far down here and climbs its way to here. And computer science starts pretty well. Look at this, 40% back in here. I think this is computer science the right color. And computer science ends up selling right about now at about 20%. And that's the numbers we're seeing in our major. That's my local view of this as well. So they're not, the 20% of the AP folks, they're 20% of us at the undergraduate level. Now, taking another look at the underrepresentation issue, underrepresented minorities, or URMs, are even a smaller piece of it. The stat in yellow is the current number of URMs represent 28.5% of the U.S. population. Yet, so you should hopefully see 28.5% of the BS majors at the undergraduate level, 28.5% at the master's level, 28.5% at the PhD level. Look how bad the numbers are. We call this the dwindling pipeline, where folks fall out of the pipeline at some point and decide that they like computer science as undergraduate, but then they want to go get a job. And some smaller percentage will get a master's, and then certainly there are fewer people getting master's degrees than undergraduate degrees, but they change what they look like. The folks who we need to stay with the program and even increase are falling out saying, I need to get a job because I have some other concerns or because that's a better option for me. So it gets a dwindling pipeline, it's now 1/10 of the numbers. 32.6 is about 2.8. face. And what we see here is a wonderful book by Jane Margolis, who looked at the LA Unified School District. How many of you have read this book? It's a delightful book. Okay, about five or so. Out of 30 for those of you online. This is a delightful book in which they did a deep dive into looking at both a trio of an affluent school, kind of a middle-income school, and a really underserved school in LA Unified School District. And they looked at the computer science computer science courses at these three schools and what that meant. And they were dysfunctional for three different reasons, but they were certainly dysfunctional in aggregate. So computer science, even if it's a wealthy school, isn't real computer science. You're not teaching you're not engaging kids. You're teaching PowerPoint and internet search and calling that computer science. Not necessarily all three of those cases, but some of those cases. So the reality that Jan pushes for, and I certainly subscribe to, is that we need to focus on the high school piece to fix that. So we're not producing enough people. They don't look the right way. And K-12, the future doesn't look bright because the next generation isn't engaged and isn't getting great instruction. So we got to fix the high school piece. And this is just a piece of the same puzzle. This is the AP exam taker. So if you kind of go back to this is 97, this is only, you know, 15 years or so. But what you're seeing is all the numbers are striding up. Everyone's taking more AP exams. Everyone's getting excited as the population isn't growing. This is great. All those normalized population are pretty flat. So they're doing pretty well. Some of them grow a little bit faster than population. But the one that's constant, even though population isn't growing, is computer science. So AP exam is broken for a couple of reasons. One is broken because it's not a gender breakdown. Gender equal, and also people aren't taking it. People aren't engaged with this course. There's something wrong with that course, maybe. So let's talk about that. So how do you fix K-12? I propose a multi-pronged approach, and Jan and other folks agree with that. One, it might be, let's look at that AP course. Let's see what we can do about that. And we've tabled that one for now. That isn't the focus of this initiative. The focus of this initiative is to really think about, that course is fine. I would say it's great, it's fine. But it really requires the language is Java, it's very syntax heavy, and it's hard to go from Jump Street, from having no computing experience in this course and doing well in that course. So wouldn't it be great if you could introduce a course before that had more breadth than just programming in this professional language that lets you program in a lighter language that was still rigorous, still an AP, but taught the broad perspective what computing had to offer. So introduce the gold standard course, computer science principles. And that's the idea of this talk, and that's what drives all of my work, is thinking about this amazing, and I'm at the advisory board for this, so thinking about this amazing course that really does take a broad perspective of, A, engaging kids in learning a program. That's still part of it. You can't just read about it and think it's fun. You have to do it to really get your hands dirty to get some of that, so that's great. But also thinking about the big ideas and the computational thinking practices. So as part of the template for that, we have six great big ideas and seven computational thinking practices that drive that. And that's just a framework on the wall. That's kind of like the principles to live by. That's like the Ten Commandments lived out there. But you have to have instantiations, of course, that actually says, I'm going to try to attack that. So that's where we come in. So the single source of national leverage is that you're fighting 50 different fights unless you make something that can change nationally. So the adding a new AP course was concluded to be the way to make this national change. We're very excited about that. So the CSNK project is, the goal is, and this is a picture of Jane Margolis and her folks at LA Unified with Joanne Good and other folks here. How can we get engaging, rigorous computing courses into, now there's roughly 23,000 high schools. Can we get this into just 10,000? That's the kind of number we threw out there. 23,000 is really too big to try to tackle in the first run. But if we can get it to 10,000, and maybe 10,000 is a really high population, maybe urban density places, we can really make a difference in terms of the representation as well as the numbers. Now we can amp up the number of people taking this course. They're all engaged. Some of them might decide to take the APCS course and become a major, but that's okay if they don't. The part of this goal is to really introduce students to a really amazing, rigorous course that if it's the last course they take in computing, you better be happy with that because you might have just one chance. So this is like the one shot. I feel like Eminem now. It's like, no, one shot. Don't blow it, right? So this is it. And the goal is to get them engaged by 2016. So this was the map of the first round of pilots. And one of the pilots were at University of Washington, Larry Snyder, Beth Simon at University of California, San Diego, Jody Paul at Denver, Tiffany Barnes, North Carolina, and Bling, me. So we were chosen as one of the five national pilots for this new class. and we were really excited and engaged about being part of this and able to share our work. So, ta-da-da, now my talk really starts. So that was just the preamble, and this is the real ta-da-da. Okay, so if you were asleep, now you can wake up, and here we go. So this is the beauty and joy of computing, and it has a lot of yellow on the slides. It must be an important slide. And it is a team effort. One of the nice things, if I go back to the slide, Tiffany Barnes, on the right side of this, actually has second move advantage. If you're a chess player, sometimes it's better to kind of wait and see what the other person does, then you can pounce on their mistake. So the four of us on the left part of this map all ran our courses in the fall. And so we all did this. We all had weekly conference calls. So we all had tight collaboration to make this course great and help each other in many ways and even share midterm examples and all that. It was great. It was a really dynamic. This is the fall of 2010, by the way, just taking you back in time. Fall of 2010. So now, we were doing this, and it was outstanding. Tiffany got to wait until the spring to teach her course. So she got to watch all the missteps we did and all the things that we did that worked and things that didn't work, all those trials of this new, exciting, engaging course. And some of us have taught courses like this before. I've done this. Larry Fetter taught his fluency course. We've done something like this before. So all of a sudden, Tiffany looks out at the crowd and says, let me go into a whiteboard and design the perfect course. Okay, now let me look over here and see which of these courses looks like that one. And she looked and said, Dan, your course is exactly what I was designing. And she said, can we work together and actually partner? Can I borrow your materials? I said, I'd be more than happy to share everything we had with you. So Tiffany taught our exact course, but she got to add her little expertise here and there. She's got some grants to do the engaging in games with a purpose. And so she likes Game Maker and engaging kids and making their own games and design of all that sort of wonderful stuff. So she added that to the end of our course and kind of just pulled something out and added stuff in there. So she kind of refined it to make it her own. That was totally fine. So we got our first example of someone doing that. Should I not be answering questions now, or is it okay to answer local questions? I think you told me not to do that. I'll just say it, because everyone will hear it. I'll just say it, it's fine. This was all to university folks. The first pilots were all five university pilots. The next round of the AP was some university and some high school. We were certainly working with local high school teachers. We actually got a mini grant to work with local high school teachers to help us influence the course, and they were taking the course and giving us suggestions for how to model. So it wasn't just an ivory tower view of this. It was really working hand-in-hand with the local high school, engaged high school teachers, some great folks. Ray Peterson, Josh Paley, and Eugene Lynn were our three amazing high school teachers who helped us with this. I want to thank them for all that work. So this is why this isn't just a Berkeley thing. This is a team effort of University of North Carolina, Charlotte, Tiffany and her team, and Berkeley putting this together called the Beauty and Joy of Computing. We even created a nice logo in the top right. Summarize, this is BJC, the whimsy and the fun that you have in our course. We spent some time with that. So we got some success. We went to Lockheed Martin. We said, you know, we need some money to help develop this course. And the course is really for diversity and to expand the reach. It's really broadening participation. We drank a little bit. We realized that has to happen at Berkeley as well as nationally. Can you help us with that? Lockheed Martin says, fine, here's a big check. So they helped us with some of the development to pay for our students to work on labs and that kind of thing. APCS Pilot Principles Pilot Times 2, that's Tiffany and myself. We applied locally to a curriculum innovation grant. We call it the Bears Breaking Boundaries Alliteration Contest. And we won that one, so that was great. And we also applied for a UC online pilot. I'll talk about that a little later, which is the University of California, the 10 campus structure said, we need to go online. This is crazy that other folks are going to beat us to the punch. We're maybe 10 years behind the curve here. We want to have call for some courses that could go online. And I said, oh, wow, imagine a world when this course were online, how that would help feed into the CS10K solution. I applied, and we got one of those as well. So I feel like it's really wonderful how all these things are kind of fitting together in a perfect way. The status is we started, NSF helped us with some PD, and I'll talk about that near the end. The status of this has been, we started real small with a small pilot in 2009. So we actually had our first course taught with this exact structure before the AP folks were even picking up five pilots. That map, they haven't even picked that. We were already teaching the course. So by the time it came out, we were the only course who had been taught already by the time they were picking pilots. So we felt comfortable teaching it for the second time and having learning from that first pilot that wasn't viewed by the world. It was only 16 students. So we went with our pilot for 90 students in 2010 fall, and then we kept going, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. So then we had 90 students that spring, then we had 25 high school teachers online in a very kind of cobbled together of this tool and that tool and some duct tape and some bag bomb, and we just kind of made it happen. So we learned a lot about what didn't work from that to evolve to the next thing we did that. So then the course grew to 250, which is great. We're hitting 500 students a semester, and then we taught 70 students, and this is our first round of NSF-funded professional development. I'll talk about some about that. And now we're at 250, now we're actually at 300 now. So I'm really excited about that number. It's quite incredible. 250 is now 310. And I hope to get a lot more folks coming up this spring. So we're really excited about where we are in the course. Now, I don't want you to leave this room thinking this is a Dan Garcia course. This is a team of a lot of people building this course. So Brian Harvey is another senior lecturer alongside myself, and we co-developed this course as the leads initially with these amazing two grad students, Colleen and Luke, both of whom have gone off to be great pastors. Luke is now at Google, and Colleen is now at Harvey Mudd as a professor. So all these were award-winning graduate student instructors who helped us build this class, as well as maybe 30 other undergraduates who came and wrote a little package here, wrote a tool here, and helped us. So it really wasn't just Dan alone, this is all me, rah, 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 pat me on the back. It's a lot of us who worked on this project. And again, Tiffany added her expertise of the game stuff and gave us a lot of critique on the early version of that. So all of this was really a team effort. So people keep telling me, Dan, what course is it? You keep saying, rah, 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 this is a great course. What is it? This is the course in one line. So let's reflect on this for a second. So in the olden days, our non-majors courses were just programming because we didn't have someone kicking us in the pants saying, Dan, think about the fact that computing makes a difference in society and tell us how that impacts the student, impacts society with the computing that you're building. Where is that? And so our old non-majors course was just Scheme. It was a great course, but it was about learning Scheme, and it wasn't about what you can do with Scheme or what you can do with computing and research summaries from other fields. So we really took a step back and we said, we need to build the greatest course ever, a course that if you only had one semester with somebody who's a non-major, they're going to take your course and go away and never again take a computer course, what should they know? And that was a great design. So we kind of, that was one course. And then you say, well, here's the AP Principles model. And in fact, they kind of do this. It's really quite amazing. Of the course, the perfect course I would have built, and what AP Principles wanted was like 95% there. And Jan goes with the 95% rule. If you're happy with 95% of it and you can live or abstain with 5%, let's move forward. And that's where I was. I was really happy with 95% of that mapping to my course. I was really delighted with how well we aligned with that. And most people, by the way, most people who have seen the AP Principles course framework are happy with it. There's been a lot of review of a lot of really smart, wonderful, caring people about that, massaging those principles, the great ideas, and the computational thinking practices. So we're past that. Now it's how do we implement it? No one's still fighting about that. It's delightful that we're all on board in the same way, and that's really, really heartening for me. So it is both a two-pillared structure where the big ideas of programming and then big ideas of computing, and that right column was never there. That's what Principles did. That's what having our eyes open to what you should have in a course is there. So let me just go through some of the things we do, and this is not a required list. But this is like a sense of what kind of things we do, and you can pop this lecture in for that one, and it still does that. So one of the things we want to do is demystify computing. There's a movement of how stuff works. There's a very popular website that tells you how engines work and all that stuff. So we want to talk about how stuff works that kids care about. So how does 3D graphics work? How does action that video game that I spend all my spare cycles on, how does that actually work? So we bring folks in, we talk about that. So we talk about the graphics behind it, as well as how do you even make a video game, and what's the design structure that goes into that? What's the asset creation? We talk about computational game theory, which is one of my passions. It's just using computing horsepower to solve board games, and I've done some research in that. It's really fun. We've solved the game of Connect 4. People still play that now. It's a lot of fun. We've actually solved it. It took us a week on 30 machines at 8 cores each, and it was X many core hours to do this. And we end up having a 2-terabyte data structure that you never have to lose a Connect 4 ever again. And I say ever, I mean it. Ever again. Pretty cool that the answer is now. And some people liken that to cutting down the trees in the Amazon. Like, don't solve it because I don't want to know. Oh, now that you've told me. But anyway, the structure is a big long table, but it's still fun. So we did that. I shared some of that love and I shared some of that work that we do locally. Then in the olden days, you know, many courses have surveys. You know, a lot of freshman courses are survey courses where you have somebody come in and talk about their research. And they come in and say, here, and that's the easiest talk for any faculty to give. Just talk about your research. And they already have the slide presented and they go, blah, 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 my little window, small window of my world. I said, we got to change this up. This is not about that small window of your problem. I need you to summarize the entire field of AI. And I said, yes, this is your only chance to attack this group of students. Summarize all of AI, where all the threads are, all the exciting pieces are. And they say, let's do it. So they do that for probably the two most exciting areas that I see that are going forward for the students is AI and self-driving cars and Siri and all of that. And HCI, you know, you're interfacing the computer with your hands and this, and what does that mean and how do you build interfaces, how do you measure them and prototype them, all those things is HCI. So they summarize memorize all of HCI and all of AI, and the students love those lectures. Then we have apps that change the world. How can you change the world with this, with a map and all these things? How does the internet work as part of that thing? Social implications of computing, that's a really important thing. That talks about the ethics and privacy and copyrights, and when things go viral, what does that mean? When things become bits, what does that mean? Saving the world with computing is a live lecture where we have folks talk about the work at LBL for climate change models and how that influences policy and influences Washington. We have an industry guest lecture from Twitter. We've had Pandora come by. The students love this. So they talk about, they say, you know, the stuff you're learning in your class is relevant to me in my work, and I'm 12 years more senior in terms of classes, but exactly what you're learning is exactly the problems I'm dealing with over here. It's really cool. Cloud computing, limits of computing, and the future of computing. And on the programming side, the things we've usually had, the things on the top we've had before, the things we've never had in our particular course, were programming paradigms. We step back and say, you know, you're programming in Scheme, which is, in the old days, it was Scheme, but we never step back and say, you know what, Scheme is just an example of a functional paradigm, and there are other paradigms you can consider when you think about a problem, other tools in your tool belt when you become a graduate student or a graduate of this course. Concurrency. So we actually, because we use, the next slide, I'm going to give you a little tip. We use a Scratch-based language, Scratch from MIT, it's amazing. They have concurrency built in. You have two sprites, they both do the same thing at the same time. So how do you deal with that? So we have a little bit of discussion of concurrency distributed computing. We just recently introduced big data, we're really excited about that. And games of the purpose is something that Tiffany's added with her games work. Why do I call this the beauty and joy of computing? Well, all work is done in pairs. So no student comes in and feels frustrated. I'm coming in solo, I don't know computing, I'm scared. There's a reason I was a computer science major, Dan, so don't kill me with this stuff. And I say, no problem, you're going to work with somebody who also is that same way, and you'll work together, and whenever you have a question, you can always ask each other, and friendships are formed, and networks are formed, and it's wonderful. So all of that work is done in pairs, and in fact, that we already had before the AP principles coming around, that is computational thinking practice number 7, that successful pair work is part of that goal of that course. So we have it already, it's part of our fabric. They do 2 3-week projects of their own choice. This is a really fundamental thing. There's a whole movement in the 60 community to have nifty assignments where you're going to mandate an assignment across the whole class. Why? Because you're going to be teaching to 500 students and you can't have 500 people do 500 different things. We said at this non-majors level, as long as they're doing something engaging that's real, that shows that they actually learned the material, we can have people working with them to adjust their difficulties so that they're choosing a project important to them. So really this is an anti-nifty thing where it's not like, go find some really cool thing and make everyone do that. It's exactly the opposite. Let everyone do what they want to do. And that's just delightful. So that really engages the students because they do things they've been wanting to do all along. And that's just really exciting. And they also do a 3-page paper. In the first generation of this, they had a paper where they write a paper and submit it to us. And we grade and give it back to them. I said, you know, we're missing some social piece of this. So we changed it that they write a blog. The same research. They do some research. They have some references. And then they write a 1-pager rather than a 2 or 3-pager. But what they do is they write this 1-pager and then submit it to a social public space digitally. And then they are forced to look to their right and read that person's paper and then write a paragraph reflection on that. Look to the left, read that person's paper, write a 1-paragraph reflection on it, and then pick any other thing that you want to do. Pick one more paper that they like based on the topics and make a comment on that. So everyone gets at least 2 people commenting on your own work as well as our graders. So it's really good. We're really excited about the social network that's come into that. So this really does have a beauty and joy piece to it that other courses, our own courses included, have never had before. In terms of format locally, we have the most contact hours of the entire campus. We believe that learning can happen when you're there helping them, doing things with them, not just go do it away and then come back later. So we looked across the entire campus and said, what's the most contact hours a week any course has? What's the record? They said, well, chemistry has a course with 7 hours a week. We said, that's what we want. So we figured out a way to kind of structure our course to have 7 hours a week. And this is a Monday, Wednesday, Friday structure, but I like to think of it as actually every day, in which you take the two labs here and move them to Tuesday, Thursday. So I like the idea that you have a lecture on Monday, kind of an overview of something, and then you actually do something for 2 hours, an engaged, excited lab where you're doing and playing. The learning happens in the doing. We all know this. Not the listening. It's the doing, not the watching. Then you have another lecture that gives you the perspective into this, and then learning happens on the Thursday. And then discussion summarizes the whole week. That's really a nice kind of metaphor for how that works. You have big idea, do it, big idea, do it, and then let's summarize and talk about it and engage. Maybe have some CS Unplugged activities where we all pretend to be a data structure or something really fun, and they really engage in that. And this happens for 15 weeks. So this is about 100 hours. It's about 100 contact hours, and there's 5 hours a week outside of the class. Select reading comes from this delightful book called Blown to Bits, here you see on this side. Blown to Bits is by Hal Abelson and others around Harvard and MIT. And Blown to Bits is a So in fact, here's the key thing that's the highlight for us. As we were designing our course, we said, we can't design a course that has a required robot component, which requires $2,000, and a required book component, which might require a lot of purchase of that, and requires a request. We have to have something that has no barrier to entry, so that the poorest, poor, Steve Martin talks about it, somewhere right now, there's the worst surgeon in the whole world, and somebody has an operation with him today. So somewhere in the United States, there is the most underserved, underfunded course. And hopefully they have computers, because that can help a little bit.
If you have computers in your lab, it's tough.
So the digital divide is supposed to solve that recently in California. But hopefully they have computers, and we want to have a course that anyone can teach. They can't say, well, we don't have money for it. There's no money. It's a free course. And every single one of the resources that we've developed are free and online. So nothing is hidden away. In fact, we even give our exams away. One of the things that are early having a tight feedback with our teachers, I said, Dan, it's really hard for us to write the exams. You know, I get your course, I teach it myself, but I don't know how to write an exam like you do. What can we do? We said, what if we wrote our exam and didn't put them online for our students, but handed them out? We've got to be able to hand them back the solutions and all that stuff. But what if we didn't put anything online? What if we gave them to you in a secret Dropbox that instructors only had access to? They said, done. So I'll even put the Word file so they can actually modify and use it, and they can use it in their own class for free, totally. So I'm writing exams for my course. I give them away to the students and to the teachers, I mean. So that's great. So Slack reading for these wonderful things. There's some CACM articles. There's some web pages, current events. We do current events every single day. We start every class with current events today about computing. Bam. And we're grounding this course, and this is real because today we're talking about computing effects today. It's all about Facebook IPOs and money stuff. It's about, here's this new technology that just was invented, and that allows us to do this and this and this. It's amazing. Or we just recently, Sacramento passed a law that said you can now have self-driving cars. What does that allow us to do? All those exciting things. So some of the policy that comes through as well. Resources are free. Readings are great. BitBook is the anchor of this. So BitBook helps anchor the ethics of the course, the social implications of computing. In lecture, it's not a boring lecture either. Hopefully you're getting a sense that the lecture is going to be engaging and fun. It's not just me talking every 50 minutes. I talk for 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden I'll stop. Every single one of my students has a clicker. Some of the money from Lockheed Martin went to buying clickers. In other courses, they make the students buy the clickers every semester. But I had enough money left around from Lockheed Martin that I was able to buy the clickers for my students. I bought 300 clickers, hand them out, get them back at the end of the year, and their clickers are free. So I have clickers. Now, if you say, well, Dan, there's a cost. Aha, I got you. I don't want to have your clickers. Well, you can have a free clicker situation by having colored index cards. And you can just have colored index cards and just hold up like this, and if your hand can block the back of it, you get basically anonymous voting because no one can see the back of what's behind you, and you're giving a color to this, and I can very quickly look at it and say mostly red, some yellows, and I can get a sense from my A through E based on color mapping like that. So even the clickers you can use in your class, you as a potential teacher can use in the class. So I ask a question, and then you all vote, and then I have you talk to your neighbors. This is probably from Eric Mazur out of Harvard, Delightful Work. And then you talk to your neighbors, and then you come back and you vote again. So this is really a way to make this engaging. And Beth Simon does this like crazy. She has like 20 clicker questions in her lecture. So she really believes in the clicker model. We do a fair amount of it, but not as much as Beth does. But it's great. And it really engages. And the nice thing is, you're getting feedback. So the students are getting lost. You can stop class and say, look, all of you voted the wrong answer. Let's step back and understand what the principles are. Let's go back and teach you some of that. So it's a really great way to stop lecture if you have time for that, to do that. So we're looking at creating this course. I talked about the structure of the lectures. I didn't talk about the actual programming of it. So we looked back and we said, you know, Alice is good. We love Alice. We looked at Python with even multimedia extensions that Mark Gusdal and Georgia Tech has. But we said the one that really looked like the winner, the course that was going to win, was Scratch. Scratch had, and it's now, it wasn't that big back then, but it was over 1 million. Now it's almost 3 million projects. So Scratch has really engaged the K through maybe 8, K through 9 space, but hasn't really gotten grabbed on. And I said, let the kids move on after Scratch. So we said, why do they move on after Scratch? Well, one of the reasons is they don't have functions. If you draw a square in Scratch and say, I want to call this draw square and be able to use that other places, you can't. You have to copy that and put it here and here and here. That's not computer science. Computer science is functional abstraction. You put a ball around and say, this is draw square, and then you call it draw square again. Maybe you have an input that tells you how big the square might be. Scratch doesn't have that. Scratch does have it now, thanks to our pushing. But Scratch 2.0 that's coming out will have that, but it didn't have it before. So we actually created something called BYOB. BYOB stands for Build Your Own Blocks. And BYOB adds functions, I mentioned before. lists were special in Scratch. They were things that were global. They lived over there, and then you couldn't just return a list on the fly. I can't just make a list and go, his list. I can't take in a list. I can't do all the things that you know. You could take in a list, but you can't return a list on the fly. So we added generic lists. Lists are now first-class objects. And we added lambda. Lambda means functions are first-class data. So I can make draw square, but not even in Scratch can I drop draw square in and say, let's say I want to make my sprite draw five different things. One of them is draw square, one of them is draw this, one of them is draw this. So guess what? In BYOB, I can make a list of five functions, and I then can drop that list into a function. It says do everything on this list to do. So it's like a to-do list, right? I go and buy eggs, I go and drop my clothes off at the cleaners. So it's a to-do list. Why can't you have a programming language as easy as we've created to be able to say, here are functions that do things, wrap them in an aggregate like a list, and pass it in as an input? That's amazing. And the idea, many people haven't been taught higher order functions, but it's not that hard a concept, and the kids don't think this is hard either. So one of our research questions is, can high school kids really get the idea that this power, that you can just pass around functions as easy as you can data? And that's a really powerful idea for abstraction as well. So we've created BYOB. Here's us making a for loop. Many languages have a for loop in their language, but how many of them could write a for loop if it didn't exist? That's very hard, actually. So here is a for loop where it looks just like a for loop, and here I'm editing it, and I'm using it, and calling it, and there's the exact loop running it. So the nice thing is, we said to ourselves, we asked teachers, are you happy with this? They said, you know, we're happy except for two things. And they went, well, it's a little slow. Said, okay, well, we're kind of inheriting Scratch's code base, and Scratch is a little slow because it's an interpreted language on top of an interpreted language, so it's a little slow for that reason. And they said, also, we would love it if we didn't have to install anything. Sometimes we don't have administrator access to our computers. So what do I do? I can't live with Scratch because I can't install it myself. I'm stuck. Well, what if we gave you something in the browser? They said, that would work. So we were looking at the space, and there was Flash, and there was JavaScript and HTML5. We said, let's go with JavaScript and HTML5. About 6 months after we decided that, they discontinued Flash development, mobile development access. And so, unfortunately, the Scratch community went with Flash before that, partially because they needed the sound. There was a good technical reason why they needed the Flash. They needed to get the sounds and have backward compatibility with all their amazing 3 million projects. But they went with Flash, and what that means is every single iOS device can't use the Scratch in the browser. In fact, the Scratch folks even tried to write an app for Apple, and Apple said, no, no, no way. And they said, why? Well, because you could write Angry Birds in Scratch, and then people would use your Angry Birds happier than the Angry Birds they had to pay 99 cents for, and we wouldn't get any money from that. So Apple stopped allowing people to write development environments in iOS. But Apple can't stop you from what? Going to a web page. So all of a sudden, this is Hal Ableton's talk at 60 last year, tearing down the walled gardens. Take back your iPad. You should be able to write code on your iPad, and thanks to us, you can. It's really beautiful. So Snap is our version there, and there's a little picture of it. It used to be an iPad, but the version of the iPad. So I want to show you a little bit of this. So this is BYOB. It looks like Scratch, if you've seen Scratch. I want to show you this, I believe, is the greatest project ever created for BYOB. This was created by two students, in 3 weeks. People who had never programmed before. So they went through 12 weeks of our class, never programmed before, and then for their final project, they built this. And this so blew me away, I've gone to conference with this office, they say, how did they do that? And you'll see how clean an interface is. These folks were music majors. So this is, again, part of that piece of letting people choose what's valuable to them. These are music majors, and they wanted to make a little looping program. So this is called Magic Machine. You start this, and you see this. I'm going to see if the volume's the right volume. And this is left to right. You see a time code going by. I'm just going to add a little click on the bottom. Just click once. You hear a little rhythm. And I can do this. And I can do this. Now, I'm not a music person, but imagine someone who had some talent. I've played this 100 times, and it's never the same way twice. This is what Hal Ableton calls a generative technology. I give it out there, and then you create something that I could never have envisioned giving. It's like a word processor. I can't imagine what novel you'd write with that. I can't envision what you'd ever create with this. This allows you to be creative at another level, like a micro tool. It's really wonderful. So this is just delightful, delightful, delightful. It even has a really cool feature called Mutate. It takes a long time, but what it does is, let's say you get a perfect song, like you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb. You click mutate, and it changes into those blocks. It, like, perturbs them, kind of shakes the Scrabble board up a little bit. And so you hear Mary Had a Little Lamb a little off key, a little faster, slower. It's really quite fun, but it takes a long time to run. Anyway, delightful thing. You can edit this, and it's just really, really, really delightful. Real, this is the best I've ever seen. And look how clean the interface is. No, I mean, you're just clicking it. And this could be, this could so work on an iPad. Just touch those blocks and it works. It's just really, really, really exciting. So that is an example of BYOB. I also want to show you this one. I have, I put it right in the front of my thing. My son is programming in BYOB. And so this was his second program. My son is 7 years old. He was six when he wrote this program. But I want to say, show you the range. These are people, you know, seniors and juniors at Cal. And it, this same program scale, because it's based on Scratch, which is so great for the K through 6 or 7, 8 or 9 space, this is his first program he ever wrote. We ended up watching the moon landing and talking about that, so we watched this. Then he wakes up before I do, and he gets to have some computer time, which is programming time, before I get up. I got up, and he had written almost all of this, and he said, Daddy, how do you change the background? So all I really showed him is how to change the background, but everything else is his. The sound is his, the graphics are his, all of the logic is his, except for changing the background. That's all I told him how to do. Okay? Watch this. So I'm going to full screen this guy. And then space bar. And this is a rocket launch.
Liftoff!
He was 6 years old, by the way. And so now the rocket that he drew himself, and this is Cape Canaveral, it goes to the top of this, and then it scrolls to the next, and now it's in space. And I can fly around. It's a lot of people in that heart, right? I'm flying around the stars. I'm in there. I told him how you should make the bottom flutter like a rocket ship. And now, he learned about Mars. He learned about planets. So he said, oh, this is Mars. Mars is a red planet. He drew a Mars. He did this. I'm flying around here. Okay, all of his drawing, all of his animation. Now Saturn. He knew that Saturn had the rings. And so now he's at Saturn. And now we get to the moon. And when we get to the moon, he said, I want it to land on the moon. So we knew how to scale it down.
People have landed.
He's 6 years old writing a BYOB function, writing code in the same way that my students have been doing. This is an engaging, exciting thing at all levels. It really at all levels. So kind of Scratch hits a wall where you can't really do fractals and recursion because you have no function. You can't do generic lambda. You can't do lisp. You open that wall up, and now the same program can be done from can be start from K and go all the way to university levels. It's really exciting about that. Now, we're talking about Snap. Let me just show you what Snap looks like. So here is Snap, and it looks just like BYOB does. I can go, and I can change. I even added this clicking sound, which I love here. So I'm going here. And now I'm programming by just dragging blocks. And this is, you can do this in your iPad. You're just dragging blocks with your finger. And it's just delightful, delightful, delightful. So this is just as good. I can go over here. This is the main Snap web page. I can scroll down and say, you know what? I really like the whole Jurassic Park. This is a fractal I wrote. So I click on this. And if my website is still up, it will create this. I have a button that full screens it. And I can run this. And this works on my phone. I can go and find this URL and have the same animation on my phone. So the fact is, people talk about mobile development, you have to go to a custom App Inventor, which is great, I love App Inventor, or other tools to get kids excited about getting programs on their phone they can carry around with them. How about the idea that you write it on a computer, which is a little bit easier than developing on a thing, which is how App Inventor works also, you write it on a computer. And then, rather than having to solve it and download it to the phone, you just have a URL that you point your smartphone browser to, and you're running and playing the same program you've had all along, but it's running from the cloud rather than locally downloading it locally. So this is just exciting that you could imagine having all these interactive things the kids are walking around with that they ran, that they wrote themselves and ran themselves, and they're carrying around in their phone. Exciting stuff. So I have this locally, if I can find around, I can actually find the same exact program running on my phone that I could write. And this is just a double dragon fractal. So that's great stuff. So the language is great. How about testimonials? Well, here are two students who tugged on my shirt collar and said, Dan, I need to tell you how much this course meant to me at the end. So, you know, anybody, any even remotely interested in computers, take this. And this is, if I had taken this course early, I would have changed majors. This is a senior, and Justin's the gentleman on the left. And he said, this class is so engaging. If I had nothing to do, I would have been a CS major. And so that was fine. I made one video. And the next year I taught it, I had 17 people come to me independently. I didn't ever call. I didn't say, hey, if you want to tell me how much the course meant to you, come find me. I didn't say that. Independently, people were handing the final exam and saying, damn, that exam was harder. Can I tell you how much this course meant to me? I said, yeah, do you mind if I take another room and film you? They said, sure. And so I did this 15 times, and two people came in. So this is, I have a YouTube playlist that I'm happy to share with you, which is 17 people telling me, this course changed my life, this course is amazing, this course works, how dynamic is this? And it's exactly the demographic we wanted. We were so excited about that. So really, really happy about the results we've got from our local version of Beauty and Joy Computing. Yes, but how well are they doing? Yes, they're being engaged, but are the women doing very well? Well, this is a kind of a weird graph. What I've done is the left two graphs are the old class I had, which is a non-majors class in computing and scheme. The right two class is the new one, the CS10 class, the Beauty and Joy Computing. And so what I did was I looked at the percentage of women that were in these classes. It numbered from 32% to 45%, and it stayed stable at 40%, but even grew a little bit. So the women are there at about 45%. But how are they doing? And this is one simple metric of, I looked at the top spreadsheet. I looked at my spreadsheet in Excel, and I just kind of made a screenshot of it. And which of the students were women in that screenshot at the top? I ranked them by the best student. And you'll see that they're not really in the best core students in the old class. This is just comparing old class versus new class. But look how dense they are in the new class, right? This green line hasn't changed, but look at how many more women are doing really well, the top 22 out of 200, out of 80 or out of 200, than they did back in the olden days. So if you look at the percentage of women in this graph, out of the top 22, what percentage of women there, you'll see that even though I only have 45% women, there are almost 60% women on this graph. So they're doing great. They're at the top of the class. And in fact, for the first time in history that I've been with this class, the top student was a woman. I was really excited about that. But yes, okay, a couple of top kids, but overall, how are they doing? Well, their GPA is statistically significant higher than the men. So they're doing a 306, about a B center, about a B plus center class, and the men were doing a 287. So that's basically a plus minus grade differential. People ask me, why do you think that is? Well, for the first time, we're having a major part of this class be writing, reading assignments. There's reading and then writing about whether you understand the reading. So that's a bigger part than the old class was, which was just programming. But also this course is bringing into the, it's more than just the right brain of it. It is touching a lot of the creativity that you didn't have in the old class, which I told you how to do my tic-tac-toe example. They're doing their own creative thing, and they're blowing up in terms of success with those things. So they're having their own creativity enhanced, and they're engaging the right part of their brain. And now, even at Berkeley, by the way, the GPA of women is higher than men. So at Berkeley, they're smarter than us, and that's it. So they're showing that in this class, that same as the Berkeley GPA numbers. So they're doing great. So that's the course. Now let me talk about this other. I talk about the confluence of the perfect storm. So that's the course, and we're doing great, and everybody's happy. UC Online pilot project was a visionary project of folks at the Office of the President who said, we need to get, this is for the 10 campuses, UCLA, San Diego, Berkeley, and the seven other schools. They said, we need to go in the online space. But we can't just go in full bore. We have to do some measurement. We have to take some pilots and try it, and trial things. So what they did was they offered 25 grants across all UC people who wanted to take their course online. And they provided some development support. So each course gets to define what works and what doesn't work in the online space. So we said to the CSN students, let's ask the kids, what do they want to see going online? And we gave them a kind of sampling of things we could think about. There's mini quizzes, programming challenges, tree structure interface to lectures. And they said two things we want. The other guys don't matter. These two things we want. We want mini programming challenges because we find some of the programming hard. People have never programmed before. Even that nice, beautiful interface is hard when I ask them to do a hard recursion problem. And when we get stuck, we want to have an instructor does the lab video. We actually suggested that because that was one of our E, because that was done in another course and it worked very successfully, where another senior instructor would just go and not see the homework, and then when the homework was due, the minute after the homework was due, he would turn all the lights on, and students would wait up in line, and they would then do the homework from scratch. And he would just think out loud. It was like an apprentice model where you're watching me think through the problem. They would do it from scratch and solve it in an hour that the students were spending 3 days for. So we did that. We actually filmed our own instructor doing all the labs. So all the things where the learning happens are labs 4 hours a week. We have an instructor who is the senior TA. He goes through every single drop of it and explains his thought process. And the students love that, really love that. So I can show some of that. So we built the TA does the class. We also built this programming challenges, and that's something called CodePath. And CodePath, I'm going to see if I have access to that. CodePath.co, which is, if you've seen Project Euler. So Project Euler is little challenges that you have. And so this is his master's project, actually. This is Luke Seeger's that I mentioned before, that photograph. And this is his project where you go to the system and this gives you a challenge. And the challenge has to be written by code. It might be, here's some examples, it was taking a long time. Here we go. Create a single string of letters by writing the last letter of each word in the following phrase in reverse order. The last letter of the entire passage should be the first letter of your string. and this is a link for how what this means. Or it could be, give me, what's the sum of the first million prime numbers? Something you need to write some programming for. It's not just loops and some stuff, and so we just throw out one random one every day, and the students are getting some exercise with that, and it's recording that, doing some analytics with that, and doing some stuff. This is one of the few ones that's actually not number-based. So we have that, and that's really great. So the students are really happy about those tools that we've added to this. So here's what we're doing in the online class versus the non-online class. I know I have a couple minutes, but almost done. The online class is almost the same. We have a synchronous webcast. We have 1080p recorded lectures, so here's what our lectures look like. One of the things with computers, Berkeley has joined edX. We're now Berkeley X in terms of the open source initiative for going on to massively open online courses. And I filmed myself in front of a green screen, and I placed myself on my slide, so I look like I'm the weatherman.
And a big cold
front just coming in from here. And so as you're seeing this, I'm pointing to things on the slides, and then every once in a while you'll come up with this, a clicker. And you don't click on this, and it automatically stops at these little questions. And this is the exact clicker question that I had in class that I now embed into the video. So you put your hands behind your back, and you just watch the video, and it stops, and it asks you for a question. And if you answer the wrong thing, and this is that question I showed before, what's the problem of transferring U.S. education, underproduction, underrepresentation, lack of presence in K-12, all of the above? So you say all of the above. If I said none of the above and submitted, watch what happens.
It
wakes up.
Let's see if it appears.
It circles my wrong answer, shows what the right answer is, and describes what the right answer is and why it is that way.
So it's exactly what I would have done in class.
So it captures the online clicker space. Labs, the two-hour labs with people walking around face-to-face, you do them online and you ask questions on Piazza. We have two projects in a blog. They have two projects in a blog. We have with computer exams and paper exams, and they have the same thing, but they're proctored via a remote system. So we have exactly the same class. Piazza is an indispensable tool for maintaining Q&A. It's a startup company out of the Bay Area, and they're great for Q&A. They have wiki-style answers, so there's just one instructor answer and one student question and one student answer, and it's a great way to kind of reduce the noise of news groups and other forums. So this is Dean Chris Edley, whose vision was to create this kind of money-making process for generating. We started late, so I'm hoping I can go a little bit late. For generating this course, the commodity we have at Berkeley and other schools and other UCs is we have our courses and our faculty. So can we export these and offer them to online students who can take these, get credit, and at the end of the day, what they get, they pay $2,000 a course. This is not a MOOC-free thing. This is a paid situation where I'm verifying that you are who you are. The MOOCs don't do that. The MOOCs should give you a go ticket. That's for all they care, as long as you're clicking the button. And at the end of the day, you get, if you pass the course, you get a Berkeley certificate saying you were, as if you were in my front row of my class, you have transferable credit from Berkeley or from UCLA or wherever you are. So that's the idea. So that's the pretty take it too, which is we might as well have a freemium model where I give my stuff away. One of the things I said is I use this in my PD, so I need to have my content also freely accessible. They said, no problem. So it's on YouTube, it's on course sharing, it's all these things that make it there. Many of you came to talk to hear about what we're doing with our Fragis grant. So our grant basically is to try to train teachers across the country in our BJC course. So the model is we have a university hub. It's like a flower analogy where there's a university anchor, which is the STEM, and there might be a really active CSTA chapter, which is a high school teachers association chapter around the university that often might have their monthly meetings be hosted at the university. All that is already in place. So we go find one of those active chapters that's coming to us and saying, we want to do this. We have commitment from our 20 teachers. They have at least 20 teachers. We go there for 1 week and we give them an intensive overview of the course and the software and the tools. Then they take the 4-week online course, the thing that I've been paid to develop over at Berkeley. So you see how it's like, I'm doing this, but it also benefits us. And this side of it's really delightful. They take an intensive 4-week course. Then, and here's, by the way, here's just an example of what the course looks like. This is the front page of the online course, and it tells you, welcome to CSW10. There's a welcome video, and here's each week. And you click on each week, and you say, oh, this week I'm doing reading, doing a lecture, a lab, a lecture, a lab, and discussion. And all those things are helped with online TA support for the summer. So the teachers get that online TA support as well. We have some money for that as well. Then we come back, and we do it face-to-face as well. So it's kind of a sandwich model. So we go face-to-face, then online for 4 weeks, and then face-to-face. It's a 6-week commitment. It's a lot of commitment for teachers in the summer.
And then we don't just drop them off. We then visit them, or they hopefully reconvene at that university every month and talk about best practices, and they talk about what works and how we're struggling through this week, how can we help each other, and so they're sharing resources face-to-face with that. And we incentivize the professor at the University Hub to do that, to coordinate those meetings. How this scales is we pick the best one or two or three teachers from that cohort, we bring them with us as co-leaders for the next summer. So they're learning how to be a summer leader for the PD the next summer. Then they go back and teach it again. So they first heard about it. They taught the course themselves. They were an assistant leader. They taught the course again, and now they are the solo leader. And so you kind of repeat that thing where they're grabbing an apprentice person from the year before, and there's this whole place where you can kind of scale up and more people teaching other people. It's great. So teachers are teaching teachers in our model, not just us to everybody, which is a nice, nice model. This is what we did last, the PD in the summer of 2012. So there was, we did work with the TEALS project, which is an outstanding project. Kevin Wang out of Microsoft is coordinating having professional developers work with a high school teacher hand-in-hand teaching this. And we actually have worked with him so that he teaches two courses. One is the APCS and one is an intro class, which is now our BJC class. So all the teachers teaching the intro class are teaching our material. Wonderful stuff, all funded by Kevin. So we helped their teachers. We gave them a kind of a short weekend of what BJC is. And these are the main clusters where we have Massachusetts, and here's Connecticut. We went there for a CH4HS week workshop, a week at New Jersey, North Carolina, and then we actually went down to Puerto Rico and had some experience with that. That was really eye-opening. So here's one teacher's take. You say, like, well, how did it go, Dan? I'll let you read it yourself. First of all, BJC totally rocks. We're having a blast this year, and it's only going to get better from here. The students love it, and the projects are amazing. Maybe the best course ever invented. Again, I stand on the shoulders of the giants. I'm not saying this to rah, rah, Dan, Dan, Dan. This is really the AP Principles initiative is really dynamic. We just happen to have our instantiation of that. I added a new project at the beginning of the year to ease the students in the process, but I'm sure they're going to do fine in all the curriculum. We love it, Nathan Maddox, and he's our local guy. So he's one of our star folks from Berkeley who got from our PD that first year at Berkeley, and he's just doing gangbusters now. He's really happy about that. So here's what we've learned. You ask me what I've learned so far from our first year and a half of doing this. The teacher's CS background varied wildly. In Puerto Rico, it was from someone who was a CS undergrad to someone who had really never done CS before, ever, and I was trying to teach them all of CS that you needed to do for this course, and that was a very different experience with the students, that range of folks. Some of them found that the exact course that we teach at Berkeley, we gave them our final exam, the final exam that I usually write, that's quite a hard final exam. They found it way too hard. The teachers are getting discouraged by our final exam. So we need to have a little bit graded things where this is kind of like, this is 100% of it, this is, if you get 75, we're still happy, you still find success at doing this. So kind of easing up a little bit on the final exam, not kind of knocking them out of the park with that. We focused most on the curriculum. We focused most on, like, those structures, the two pillars of here's what the course is. We didn't so much focus on the pedagogy, thinking that the pedagogy, the students, teachers already know that. Teachers are coming in knowing how to teach computer science. But, in fact, some of them wanted more of that. Some of them said, like, you know, I teach old-school computer science, which is a Java class. I want to know how to teach this in a new, engaging way where we're doing CS Unplugged activities and we're doing this. Tell me how to do that more. So we're hearing from them now that we should incorporate that more into our PD, and we're reflecting. We're changing it. We've also borrowed some grad students from ECS. We love ECS, and they have a lot of really engaging, inquiry-based things we use in that now. The question of how much counts as BJC, we don't yet have, at the end of the year, an AP Principles exam. So there is no fidelity of, you teach our course and you'll get a 5 on the AP. We don't have that yet. So there's a question of, I'm teaching 75%. Does that still count as teaching BJC, or what is that? So people are kind of saying, I teach this much, this much, this much, this much, and is that still, I still call myself a BJC family member. So there's a little question of that for ourselves. And we need this online community practice. We now have 100 more high school teachers. If we added the 70 here from last summer plus the 30 from Berkeley, we now have, you know, roughly 100 plus other people around the country who found about our stuff and randomly downloaded it and weren't part of our PD who are doing our work. How do we support those folks? How do we have a place where we can share resources and a mailing list and all that stuff? So right now we're in the process of building that online community practice, and I'm really happy to be part of that process. So in summary, high school CS is in trouble. Really in trouble, and we're trying to fix it. And we're really excited about being part of the solution, not part of the problem. This exciting, engaging BJC course is grabbing women. We're doing really well with that. 40% of the students in Berkeley are taking, which is the highest, higher by far than any percentage of students taking undergraduate courses in computer science at least in Berkeley. We continue to refine it with added tools. We're bringing in the three peers of Snap is amazing, and now we're going to be integrated to that tool. I didn't really show up all the other cool things that Snap can do. Snap can talk to robots now, and that's what Jeff was asking about. How do you deal with the makerspace? We have actually have Snap connects with robots. The Finch robot is a $100 robot that Snap can talk to. Snap can talk to the web that has a block that says, go to a URL and grab the URL and bring it back in. So I can go to grab any data source in the whole web and bring it back into my programming language natively. It's beautiful. I'll just show you. It's so good. It's just too good not to show you that. So this is sensing block, and I go here, and here's the URL, and because I'm a Mac, I'm so cool, I can zoom in. This is what the box looks like. It says http://URL here. And you put any URL. This could be a data service URL, whatever, and you click it, and it reports the summary. I'm clicking out here now, waiting for the thing to come up, clicking. Come on, don't let me down. Web. Clicking. Ah! And that is the content of the URL. It happens to be a website with, you know, tags of H1. That could just be raw data. That could be a huge, big data file. Trivially, I can bring in data file in here rather than load data into a list. Right now, it's dynamic. I can load it on the fly, grab a data file, and start using it. So it's really exciting that we're moving to big data space. I'm excited about that. So online stuff, the BJC stuff, and the Snap all coming together to be a really effective PD experience, and we're growing and learning from what we've done so far. We're really looking forward to summer 2013 and talking to folks. So if you know of a cluster of high school teachers, please pass them on to us. BJC at BSpace is our contact with that, or just BJC Berkeley.edu is the easy way to get to us. And we believe that APCS is the future of high school computing, and the future is bright. Thank you very much, folks. So now I go to questions for everybody. Is that right? You queued up some questions online, and I think there's a hand locally. Let me do that while you're grabbing that one. I'll do this quick one, and then we'll do the online questions. Yes. That's a very good question. Success of anything, how much is it because the person deleted that? Well, the one thing is Tiffany has had great success with it. So that's another thing. She's also dynamic. Well, I mean, so the real question is, if you had somebody who wanted to make this course terrible, could they? Probably the answer is yes. But the course sells itself. The course really has all the resources out there that if you just kind of grab this activity, we give away our Moodle stuff. So all those 2 hours times a week times 15 weeks, that's a lot of hours of online content. That's all there. You just use it in your own work. So that kind of sells itself. And the idea that students pick their own projects, I'm getting email from people in Puerto Rico saying, you've got to see this project my student did, and they're mailing it to me. So we're sharing. We don't have the same scratch online space for sharing stuff, but they're emailing me projects that are mind-blowingly good. And so I think the fact is we built into the fabric of this course that students pick their own stuff, and in all the three major assessment items, two projects and a blog, they're doing their own thing. It's not about me, it's about them. So, yes, there's rah-rah Dan on the screen. You can use my videos if you want, but I still think that the course runs itself successfully without somebody at the front who is good speaker. Questions? Yeah, sure.
Have you tried doing this? You kind of intimated it. You take the high school volleyball convert her into computer science teacher in order to spread the wealth here. Does it work?
It's harder. So the question was, can you convert a beach volleyball teacher to a computer science teacher? They're going to struggle through our PD, right? If you come from no computing at all, like you really, computers were scary for you. If you come in as a student, the summer is so intense. It's 6 weeks. It's, you know, it's our nice, soft 15-week introduction that students with no experience succeed and blow us away with. But you compress anything that works at 15 weeks and make it 6 weeks, it's going to be tough. So it's just every week, every day there's something new, that's a new idea that's changing your brain in a way that you didn't expect it. And the Zygotsky's ZPD, Zone of Possible Development, that says, I need to have it. The new things be just out of my reach to get. I can't grab that. We do that, but it's so fast. It's like this one, and then that one, and then that one. You're trying to climb a rope really, really fast. So it's tough. It's really, really tough. I would say that would be where Kevin Wang's solution might work, where you would have them every day be mentored with a programmer, and so we're learning slowly with that. But in our pure model, I would say that would be a challenging. I wouldn't necessarily guarantee success in that kind of case. If the person were really interested and were math and logical, you know, if they did well in math and they happened to be a volleyball teacher, but they were, you know, the question is who does well in CS, right? People who are kind of logical thinkers and can think rationally and kind of break things down. And if her desk was neat, and like, you know, being alien retentive helps a little bit being a CS person. So if you can kind of manage your own, you know, if your desk is in misarray and my car is in misarray and I can't remember where I'm going tomorrow, you're probably not going to be a great, this is just what I've seen, you know, a great program. But if you have interest, I think it can work. Questions online. I think I'm supposed to touch base with the folks who are maybe querying and asking questions online. Maybe it's quiet there. I'm seeing nothing there. Yeah, what do we hear? Sure. So what I do is I have Bits and Bytes is one of the sources of new information for me. So I will. I've subscribed to Bits and Bytes, I've subscribed to Mark Gosdell's blog, I've subscribed to Tech Review and CNN Technology, a lot of these things, and they eventually inform me. Directly linking to Bits and Bytes, I haven't done that, but I have used things that they've pointed me to, and I follow up with those resources and then use that resource. So it isn't like go to Bits and Bytes to get it, go to the original guy that you led me on to, so it's been wonderful. I thank you for the Bits and Bytes source of that. It's great. And what we've done, by the way, I haven't shown you this, but maybe I'll show it to you now. What we've done is we even have a Google Plus stream that anybody who adds the hashtag BJC News can contribute to the stream of cool things about this. And students are doing this and contributing things about BJC News. So I think I get to this by going, I think this is one way to do this. And if I do this and go, I think I had Spring 12 was my link that I have. And I click over here. And this is, here, this hasn't been up here this semester, but here's all the links to all the, just, you know, IBM computer set speed record, and that's an example of recursive drawing, some really online thing. Here's 200 times more accurate than Kinect for $70. The lead motion is going to come out, it's going to blow people away in terms of the interactivity of the tech. All these things were kind of a running blog that we were using last semester with some great links. So students are adding these, and instructors are adding these. So it's really fun to be able to have this conversation. What this has evolved this semester is on Piazza there's a thread. So like locally at Berkeley we've had the same thing, but it hasn't gone as Google. People are kind of just feeding Piazza with the tag cool website. So there's a ton of that locally, but it hasn't been shared nationally on this Google Plus account. But it's exciting to do some of that. And that's the same kind of theme. Anything that's kind of cool, the students are sharing as well, and they're feeling that they can be authors as well because they're adding to the stream as well. Yes. Sure, sure.
I think I just heard that there were several different efforts on this about
that. Yes. Yeah.
What else is going on? How is this?
I should point out URL. Thank you for that. CSPrinciples.org is the central clearinghouse for all things related to the CS Principles effort. Remember, CS Principles is just a template for what kind of a course could be. And this is one example of that course. It doesn't mean it's the course. This is one example of the course. So if you look at pilot sites, it's incredible how much they've grown. I mean, I need to give my hat off to Amy Briggs and Owen Astrocamp for growing this as it has. This is the most recent site, and I think if you scroll down here, here's another group of sites. These are people, each of these dots you see on this map is an intent to take the template and build it to what they know to be a solid course. So it's adapting it in their particular way. And that's, for every dot, you have a different course. You don't have this single unified, like what we have, this fidelity of the course. So there's exciting thing. Nick Parlante is coding in the browser. He has this little cool thing where you actually can write some cool thing and demystify it. It's like a little grayscale image of noise. It looks like noise. But in fact, if you take and turn down the red channel and turn up the blue channel, in fact, it's a picture of the Eiffel Tower. And so he has what's one model of how to do it. Mark certainly has his computational media stuff. I think that's one of the things they do in Georgia Tech. Zalus, there's a lot of different things. That's the nice thing about this principle is the AP Principles effort is they don't mandate the language. And I'm, as an advisory board member, I'm so pleased they haven't done that. It lets us be flexible and creative. If they had said, you got to do Python, we would be shackled to Python. But because they said, just teach these ideas. You can teach them anything you want to. It lets each teacher take what they know and come to it from where they are rather than have to have all of them there. It also makes PD hard because how do you do this across the thing? We happen to have our version of it, but as long as it works, it works. So it's really quite nice. It makes writing the exam hard.
So,
imagine an exam that which you have language agnostic questions. Right. That's exactly right. Because we're still at the pilot stage. We're still at the, we want 1,000 roses to bloom, and we'll figure out exactly what works and what doesn't work. So it's really a nice stage where all these courses are coming up from the firmament, and you're saying, that one's a beautiful flower, that's a good one, this is not so good, that one, got this one, that, you know. So that's delightful. I think that's the right thing to do at this stage.
So
that's a great question. What I haven't yet seen is a central clearinghouse of here are all the courses that people also are sharing. Again, one of our first things for girls was to build our courses and give it away. So our course is very easy to go and download the whole course. You can download all the lectures, all the labs, all the exams. I haven't seen that from the other. For example, there are other five pilots, the other four, because three pilots, because Tiffany and I were the same course. They didn't give away their stuff as much. You know, they said it's there, and internally we had it, but it wasn't like it's on the web and here it is.
But that's not evaluation.
No, that's not. That's not answering your question. But because people haven't, because you can't go and grab some of the course, it's hard to evaluate, like, compared A, B, to C.
You're jumping up and down.
I
think it's great.
No, sure.
What do we know about what it works and why it works?
Sure. So we're using, for our evaluation purposes, what we're doing is we're sharing our exams at Berkeley. So we're giving our exams to the local high school and say, you know, you have your own exam that you wrote, but have them take ours also. This is for the measurement of, like, how well did you adopt the BGC curriculum by giving our final exam that worked for our Berkeley students, give them to your kids and see how that did. And we're using that same exam at the end of the PD. You have 6 weeks of PD. You don't just walk away and say, thanks so much, bye-bye. You take an exam at the end of it. So that's a measurement for us is how well the PD worked. Then we have for that student, or that student got an 85. Then we wait for that year to pass, and we see how well did that student take our exam. So we're still in the process of kind of looking at, remember I said my exam was a little hard, so we're kind of looking at stages of that, so lots of different questions, and then passing it on to each instructor to see if they can do that same thing for us. That's just locally for our particular project. Right now, in the background, the AP folks are generating test questions. So that's what's happening right now, is that people are generating test samples that are being trialed at different places in Pilot 3.
That's what I was going to say. If you scroll up to Pilot 3, those sites are all now piloting tests.
And so we're in the process of, we would love to get some of these. We were actually talking to Lundia of the College Board to get access to that so we could try this with our kids to see, I mean, what they do it in an online way, so you have to be at exactly the same time. They release it and then they close it. So it's not like I can get a PDF and print it. It has to be like open and they did it. And it's happened to not synchronize with when I had students. But I would love to be in on the inner loop of this so we can kind of make sure that our course is being compliant with that and our students would be rock stars in these questions that we see. Part of the problem, by the way, if I could just go off record, is right now there's no official book. You know, you have these big ideas and these practices, but there's no grounding in a book. I have a book that's 300 pages. It's very easy for me to say, the big idea now is copyright and intellectual privacy and intellectual property and what that means in the age of the digital world and digital revolution. Okay, now read 50 pages of that and blown to bits, which talks about 70 different cases and all this and nuanced discussion about it. Now let's have a question about that. That's a real thing. I can write a paragraph. I can write a page about that. That's easy to assess. If you don't have that book to reference, you have intellectual property is an important part of moving forward with the internet, and it's often challenged by the digital millennium, you know, the digital revolution. What kind of question do you ask about that? That's just a principle. You can't ask any question about that. That's just a fact. I can repeat it to you, but it's not a. So there's meat when you have a required reading, and so I haven't yet seen required reading from them. So we're advocating rah-rah, blown to bits. I take no benefit. Their book, it's not like I got a cut. I think it's an outstanding book. So if we all decided, let's all go in together and say blown to bits is required reading that year, it doesn't have to be every year. Just say this first year, blown to bits is required reading. Then everyone read over the course of the year, talk about it, discuss it. It would be a really fruitful discussion, really engaging discussions, and then you could actually ask real questions about the social implications of computing based on that. So I need to advocate for more, a little bit more standardization to get some meat on the bone. Because right now it's just a list of principles and I really can't assess them. So what kind of questions can they ask if all you have are principles to ask about, right? You need to have some meat there. So we'll see what happens.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you, Dan.